Welcome to Juno Afternoon. It's St. Patrick's Day, March 17th. I'm Andy Klein, and happy St. Patrick's Day to you. Coming up on today's show, All Damsel, No Distress. That's women's mountaineering in Alaska. That's the fireside chat tonight, and we'll talk to the presenter. Then Melinda Moustakas is the author of a new book, Homestead, and we'll hear from her and find out about an event happening next week at Hearthside Books. Poetry Out Loud, Alaska's state finals competition, is going to be held in person on Monday. And Alaska Youth for Environmental Action's Spring Summit starts today, and we'll talk to some participants. That's all ahead on Juno Afternoon. I hope you'll join us.
Hansen Gress, Ka eat with the shu yi, we kashuk a yi tin. Jin kat ka ke jin talk, anakaya ha anikach, gunish cheese.
KTOO would like to acknowledge that we broadcast from the homelands of the Akhwan. The Kliné Di have stewarded this area for thousands of years. Today, our studios sit on a spot once part of the tidelands, now covered over with buildings, roads, and parking lots. We recognize those families who traveled to and from these tidelands to fishing and hunting grounds and to gatherings in other villages and still cherish it as an important part of their way of life for today and for future generations.
We're always amazed at the quantity and caliber of arts and culture offerings in Juneau. KTOO helps you navigate your options. Juneau Afternoon keeps you up on everything going on, and our arts and culture team introduces you to great local talent and feature stories and live concerts. KTOO helps you make the most of Juneau's cultural life, even on the nights you stay home. Your financial support makes it possible. Contribute at ktoo.org.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
And welcome back to Juno Afternoon from your community-supported public media station, KTOO. I'm Andy Klein, and with me now is the speaker is going to be talking about All Damsel, No Distress. That's Megan Tabachek. I knew I'd butcher it. I practiced it four times in front of Megan here, but it's Megan Tabachek. And Megan, thanks so much for coming.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
And you're a UAF Arctic and Northern Studies grad student, and you're also a Trail Mix program coordinator. So you have kind of you've kind of studied the outdoors and kind of this idea of mountaineering and that sort of thing, but also you live it.
Yeah, wear a lot of hats, right. And I'm also a UAS grad. So,
oh, okay, very cool.
Yeah.
Well, tell me about this idea of All Damsel, No Distress, this history of women's mountaineering in Alaska. Seems like a rich history.
Yeah, it's a really rich history that I think not a lot of people know about. And so when I started grad school, I knew I wanted to kind of study women's relationship with the outdoors and was looking for a lot of different ways to do that. And as I started doing that, I started discovering this history that I really hadn't heard a lot about. I started learning about a lot of really incredible female mountaineers, and I was kind of surprised. I went through like the outdoor studies program, and I've been a very outdoorsy person since moving to Alaska, and I didn't actually know a lot about these people. And what I started finding out is like learning about these women in their expeditions really changed my view of mountaineering as a whole and has created a lot more excitement, I think, for me about going in the outdoors.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That's really a cool thing to think about, that studying these historical figures has really influenced your modern take on going into the outdoors. When you look at the historic women mountaineering figures in Alaska, is there sort of a common thread that runs through those people?
Yeah. So what I noticed, so for me personally, I was kind of a little disenfranchised, I guess, with mountaineering. It felt very like you have to reach the summit and you have to go hard and you have to like really try. And if it's summit or nothing, you know? And I don't really resonate with that. I'm pretty mellow. I like being with my friends. And then so as I started diving into looking at these women's experiences, the common thing that I notice is joy and connection and laughter. And I'm sure there's a lot of that in men's expeditions too, but the way they were written about, especially historically, is very summit focused. It's just, you know, we fly out to the glacier, we go up and we hit the top. And so as I started reading about women, it was really fun to kind of dive into all these interpersonal aspects and themes of connecting and being afraid and talking about it. That was something that really changed for me, as I felt like all these people who mountaineered and did these things weren't scared. And so as I started reading these women's stories, I was thinking, oh my gosh, they were scared just like me. And they still did it. And they relied on their team and they relied on their friends. And it really changed the way I thought about the outdoors.
That's a fascinating thing to think about, because I relate in the same way. It seems like when you read accounts from people who are these great explorers, they don't talk about fear a lot. They just, no. It seems like, oh, they're adrenaline junkies, or, oh, that's, mm-hmm. they love it. It's a thrill.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's times when I'm in the outdoors when it's like, I am scared. I'm scared.
Yeah.
I don't like that rustling sound in the bushes or whatever it is, you know? Or maybe you're just at a spot where you're just a little bit unsure of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Very fascinating that these very accomplished people had that take on it.
Yeah, it was really cool just seeing that even at a really extreme level. And I think some of it too is just we place different expectations on, especially in the early 50s, mountaineering was really tied to colonialism and conquest and kind of putting American names on the map. And so a lot of those expeditions were run by military men. So the style of reporting they used was very similar to the military style reporting. And that's why it's so prevalent even today that you don't summit a mountain, you conquer it. When you're going up steep ridges, it's a battle, it's a siege. And I don't connect with that language. You know, I don't like battling. I don't like conquering. I like just doing things. And so that was also another really refreshing part about diving into these women's stories, is you kind of lose this battle with nature. And it's a lot more, Arlene Bloom specifically of the Denali Damsels talks about the meditative piece of just being in the mountains and connecting with the land. And she has a really beautiful quote. I don't want to try and say because I don't have it written down, but it's basically about how we don't conquer a mountain. We just stand on top of it. And within probably 20 minutes, your footprints will be swept away by the snow or wind. And so I really thought that was a refreshing perspective of, instead of conquering or battling nature, it's like a relationship with nature and the mountains that we're going up.
And what time periods do you cover in your research and in the people that you're going to be covering tonight?
Yeah. So tonight at this fireside chat, I'm talking about Barbara Washburn. So she did her expeditions in the 1940s. I think the first one was 1940 when she summited Mount Bertha, and then Mount Hayes the year after, 1941. And then up to 1949 was when she became the first woman to summit Denali. And then the Denali Damsels were the first all-women's team to summit Denali. And that wasn't until the 1970s. So 1970, actually.
Okay. So,
yeah.
But wow, those 1940s.
Yeah.
So what was what sort of gear were they using? What was the difference in what they were sort of able to use in order to do these very technical, extremely technical climbs?
I am blown away sometimes looking at the pictures of the gear. I would never go outside with what they had. And especially for women, especially for Barbara, she had so many barriers that her male counterparts didn't face. She actually summited Denali wearing a boy's parka that she sewed rabbit fur into, because they didn't have anything that was meant for women at the time, and nothing fit her well. And so she had to actually adapt like a lot of little boys' gear, because she had quite a small frame. They used closer to like knapsack style packs. And actually, one of the biggest things about these expeditions is they would take weeks and weeks. I think they were out about a month in Mount Bertha, just because it took 2 whole weeks to transport all their gear from the drop location to base camp, because they had something around 900 pounds of gear, because stoves and fuel and everything was so bulky. And actually, when they climbed Mount Hayes and Denali, they were up there for so long that they had to have consistent helicopter drops of these big drums of fuel and food. So I definitely am very thankful. I've been on some expeditions now, and it's kind of crazy being like, everything can fit in my backpack now. And at the time, they had to have multiple flyover drops. So
amazing.
Yeah.
On those climbs, are they using oxygen ever, that kind of thing, or not?
No oxygen on any of the climbs that I looked into. Which is a little unique. Sometimes people do use oxygen now on Denali. It's kind of it's a little bit of a hot topic, I think, for some mountaineers. I think if you need it, you need it. But yeah, none of these climbs, they had oxygen. However, Barbara Washburn did have a lot of altitude sickness. She frequently had altitude sickness. But actually what she found is her first expedition up Mount Bertha, she thought it was altitude sickness. Turns out a couple weeks later, she found out she was pregnant. So she actually did her first Alaskan mountaineering summit also while carrying a friend up.
Wow.
So it was kind of cool to hear about that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. And like I'm just fascinated with the idea of like what sort of tents were they using, like canvas tents or?
Yeah.
Right.
Some canvas tents. By the time the Denali damsels were out in the 70s, they had more
technical
gear, you know, some nylon tents, but the crampons were still, things were still pretty bulky and heavy at the time. Photos of their crampons are definitely not as advanced. It was kind of a whole system to strap them on. Gear was much bulkier and heavier, harder to carry, things like that. They had to do a lot of shuttling for their gear as well, too.
Someone like Barbara Washburn, what was her background? What drove her to do this?
I think one of the most fascinating parts about Barbara Washburn is her memoir is actually called Adventures of an Accidental Adventurer. She never set out to do any of this. She just fell in love with Bradford Washburn. And Bradford Washburn's kind of this larger-than-life character. He was the director of the New England Natural Science Museum, a prolific mountaineer. And she met him. They fell in love really quickly, and they got married. And she had only ever climbed one mountain, which was about a 3,000, 4,000-foot mountain in New England. So not technical at all. She hated it. And then she married Bradford Washburn. And I like to joke that it's an uncommon honeymoon because 1 month into their marriage, they started planning their trip to Mount Bertha. And really, in her book, she talks a lot about how she just did it because she loved being with Bradford. And the experience was great. And she dealt with a lot of fear because it was pretty untraditional in the 1940s to leave kids at home to go summit mountains with your husband. But she just loved Bradford and wanted to be with him. And if that meant standing on top of Mount Hayes, she would do it. So,
just adjusted and became this incredible mountaineer in her own right. By being kind of dragged along, I guess, a little bit.
Yeah, which was really interesting to me is she just had no desire to do it when she met Bradford and then became the first woman to stand on top of Denali.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And then I would guess that this kind of the opposite is true of the Denali damsels. It sounds like that's a group of women who were very driven to achieve something.
Yeah. Yeah, they are phenomenal. They were all mountain climbers too. And in the 70s, it was really hard for women to do mountaineering. And a lot of them kind of the idea for the Denali damsels came about when a lot of them have bad experiences being on teams with all men, specifically Arlene Bloom, who was kind of one of the ones to gather people together, was told that there are no good female climbers. Either you're not a good climber or you're not a female, which I was like, what does that even mean? And so it's a group of six women who kind of were fed up with that narrative. And they said, let's prove them wrong. Let's summit Denali. And what's really phenomenal about the Denali damsels is all six of them summited. Typically on Denali, there's around a 30 to 40% summit rate per group. And so they had a 100% summit rate. But on top of that, their team leader, Grace Homan, got incredibly altitude sick, actually went down. She made it to the summit and then on the way down collapsed and they had to carry her down. And it wasn't until 30 years later, Arlene Bloom was sharing the story at a climbing event in Oregon that someone who was the previous director of Denali came up and said, I can't believe that happened. If you go unconscious at the top of Denali, you have a very, very slim chance of making it down alive. And so what really inspired me to start looking into them is the fact that it's not common to rescue in people. So the fact that you had six women who no one thought could even make it to the summit, made it to the summit and also completed a self-rescue and got all six women down in the worst storm season of the year. They had a horrible storm and they had to camp and dig a snow cave overnight at around 17,000 feet. So they really just like every single obstacle they were up against, they defeated and they tackled and they stayed like united as a team too, which was really cool.
Incredible, incredible hardships and tales of true adventure. People doing it when no one thought they could. And it's an amazing thing. Well, it's the Fireside Chat. It's tonight at 7. It's at the Mendenhall Visitor Center.
Yes.
And it's once again, All Damsel, No Distress, Women's Mountaineering in Alaska is the subject. And Megan Tabachek has been with us and is going to be giving that that talk tonight. It's going to be, those talks are always go quick. So make sure you're there early. And Megan, thanks so much for coming in and just telling us a little bit about what you're going to be talking about tonight. Very exciting to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
Fascinating to hear all about it. Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Juno Afternoon on this St. Patrick's Day from Studio 2K at KTOO. I'm your host, Andy Klein. And joining us next is Linda Moustakas, who's going to read from her new book, Homestead, and also talk about her new book and talk about an event that's coming up next week at Hearthside Books, where you get to meet her and talk to her a little bit. And we'll talk to her, and she will actually be talking to Katie Bosler and be kind of doing an event there at the Hearthside Books. But we'll turn to Melinda and ask her all about it right now. Melinda, thanks for joining us there on Zoom.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Melinda, where are you right now?
I'm in Denver, Colorado.
Is that your home now?
It's my current home. I've actually lived in the last 10 to 15 years in 8 or 9 different states, so it's not home yet.
And I know you hail originally from Fairbanks.
Yes, I was born in Fairbanks, and my parents grew up in Anchorage, and then my grandparents actually were homesteaders in Point McKenzie.
Oh, all right. So you have deep Alaska roots there. Very cool. And I think that maybe goes to this theme about your book, which is this your second book?
It is my second book. I wrote a short story collection that won the Flannery O'Connor Award in 2011 called Bear Down, Bear North, Alaska Stories. And that book's about 3 generations of a homesteading family. And so the novel is actually about one of the generations of the same homesteading family. So there's definitely a crossover
there. Oh, great. So it sort of grew out of the short story, one of the short stories, this larger work kind of grew out of that.
Yeah, there were a couple of stories about the homestead and Point McKenzie and the children, but I wanted to focus on what essentially are my grandparents. The book Homestead is loosely based on my grandparents who met in Anchorage. My grandmother was visiting from Texas, met my grandfather, who was also named Lawrence. And within 7 to 10 days, they were engaged. Within 5 weeks, they were married. So essentially strangers. And then very quickly, they were on a plot of 150 acres in Point McKenzie, attempting to be homesteaders to fulfill, you know, what the federal government said they had to do to get the deed to the land. So that first winter, they were living on an old school bus out in Point McKenzie.
That's amazing that they decided to sort of become married and then immediately went into this real adventure of establishing a homestead.
Yeah. So that was sort of my inspiration behind thinking about these characters who are named Lawrence and Marie in the book, of imagining 2 people who are meeting in Anchorage on a similar timeline, except for, unlike my grandparents, who say, you know, as if it was love at first sight, that these characters are marrying for more pragmatic reasons. And I was really interested in that idea of, what if you married just so you wouldn't have to go back to Texas because you wanted to stay where your sister lived in Alaska? And what if you married because you thought you needed a family and that's what you wanted, but not necessarily you didn't really want to get married, but you thought marriage was a way to get the family and, you know, have someone out there with you to get the deed to the land. So, you know, the stipulations were you had to live on the land for a few years, build a cabin or structure you could live in, clear a certain number of acres and plant a crop. And that takes time. So the book is set between 1956 and 1959 so that they get the deed to the land. But also I was really interested in statehood of Alaska what that sort of meant.
I was going to ask about that. Yeah, these are the territorial years of Alaska heading towards a sort of what seems now to be sort of an inevitability of statehood, although it was a real fight at the time. Tell me a little bit about how that part of the history of Alaska interweaves into your novel.
So there's you know, in the very second chapter, Marie goes to the Moose Lodge, and that's actually where she meets Lawrence, but they're handing out pamphlets about statehood saying, you know, it's wrong that as Americans and Alaskans that we can't pick our president, can't vote for our president. I think at that time, even the senators were chosen by somebody else. And so this idea of, you know, not being able to vote and paying taxes without representation, that you know, argument comes up. And so I did find these pamphlets from that time to sort of pull from talking about these ideas. And then other ideas come into the book about statehood, what it might mean. It might mean very different things to Alaska Natives and Indigenous people who have been there for thousands of years. And then the Russians came and then sold this land to the U.S., obviously, and that's how it became a territory. But that, you know, no one asked them about any of this. And so, like, there's ideas about that sort of like push against these ideas of manifest destiny about what statehood might mean to different populations in Alaska.
Yeah. And I mean, something that is still reverberating today, something that's still an issue to this very day. So it's really fascinating to think about these times in Alaska before these things were sort of legally determined. You know, it was all very in flux.
Yes, there were. I mean, I think there were many years where there was petitions for statehood. So even in the book, they talk about, the vote's going to the Senate, and it's been the third time that this bill has come up, and they, you know, there was still a question of whether it would pass. So one thing that was really fascinating to research was the statehood bonfire that happened in Anchorage, that happened in the summer, I believe late July, when it was announced that Alaska would be a state. That there was this huge bonfire where they shot cannons, you know, for all the states, and Alaska is the new state. There was a parade, and it was just a really interesting, there's footage I found online through, I think Fairbanks UAF has some footage online. So I was studying, you know, what was this event about and who was excluded and who maybe was standing on the sidelines wondering what was going on. And so there's this question of this celebration. But again, I'm trying to talk about the complexities of the history and of Alaska. And I'm always sort of trying to think about these bigger questions of statehood, even when I'm showing this this bonfire and thinking about, I mean, I made up a speech that someone is talking about that is sort of gets into this idea of course we should be a state, and we're on, you know, this is our land, and this idea of ownership. And I'm like, in this book, really trying to question those ideas that people assume, oh, this is our land, and who's saying that and why, and who, you know, has thousands of years of history in Alaska and who doesn't.
It's one of those things that's can be so instructive and useful and wonderful about reading historical novels, is that you get a different opportunity to rethink these ideas because you're thinking about them and seeing them through the eyes of characters that are made up characters but are based on historical figures and historical events. And yeah, you know, it is interesting. I mean, we all see the "We're In," you know, it's headline, and people holding that up and it being sort of a celebratory time in 1959. But as you say, there must have been, and certainly we're now finding out today that as we relook at this history, it wasn't all completely one-sided.
Yes. And I actually took that headline and put it on the radio, since I know radio is really important in Alaska and a big source of communication. So that was the research of the newspapers of the time. The Cold War, which is happening. So you have Sputnik is mentioned, of course, at a bar where people go to get their news and their mail and to talk to each other. And the 50s, it's not a period of time that I'm very familiar with. So a lot of the research was talking to my family, especially my Uncle Sonny, who has spent a lot of time at the homestead. Also thinking about, you know, were pre-civil rights, but Alaska did have one of the first legislations about anti-discrimination that the U.S. inherited because Alaska became a state. and things like that, that were, you know, you have the Cold War, we're past the Korean War and the Second World War, but like my character Lawrence was born at the height of the Depression. And then you have all these things happening, plus you have polio epidemic. So there was so much sort of, I wanted my characters, even though they're based on my grandparents, they became fictional people. Mm-hmm. But I did want all this history to sort of press upon the book. And also, they're new to Alaska and they have assumptions, but I wanted history to sort of challenge them as they learned more about Alaska and these questions about statehood, about the big land grabs at federal government and the state government, and them thinking, oh, this is ours. But again, wanted to challenge those ideas.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a certain perception that the 50s was a time of sort of almost, you know, it was a boring time in America. You know, there wasn't, you know, it was past the Great War. It was before the upheaval of the 60s. It was just this period of happy growth. And of course, that's a simplistic view of any time period in the world and in America. But especially in Alaska, it was such a time of change and a time of development and a time of that would really determine, really cast our future for the coming decades.
Yes, there was so much I actually researched, but of course it couldn't fit in the novel. The novel's in present tense, which I hope I never write another novel in present tense. It was so difficult.
That's interesting. So, why was that, from a technical standpoint, why is writing in the present tense difficult? You're writing it almost like it's a diary type of thing or a memoir, but I think in the end
It is very immersive. I wanted a book where, you know, I love books where you read them and you have to sort of come up for air and shake them off and come back to your own reality. So I wanted that to happen. I do think present tense helps. It's a third person present tense that takes on, like, the chapter switch from Marie and Lawrence, or the point of view is switching sometimes from paragraph to paragraph, half and half in a chapter. And there are some chapters that are just Marie's and some chapters that are Lawrence's. Mm-hmm. But I wanted those two perspectives because I think a lot of wilderness literature as a genre is about a lone man in the wilderness finding his way. And maybe he has a dog as a companion, but I'm really interested in people who are trying to establish a family, establish a life, and all the complications that go along with that. So it was very important to me to have both Marie and Lawrence's point of view. And, you know, in the end, I think Marie is younger and she's willing to learn a little more. She's very flawed as well, but she might be a little more dynamic in that way, in that she has more to, she, you know, she's 18/19 when the book starts, and, you know, she grows up in these mm-hmm. couple of years, and Lawrence is, I think, 8 years older. And so, so the present tense, I think, really aids the reader. And, you know, a lot of people have called this novel atmospheric, which is the perfect word, where, you know, you're just immersed in the landscape. Every chapter moves forward a month. So I was always thinking about what's happening with the weather, what's happening with all the animals, what's happening with the sky, the moon, the stars, mm-hmm. the ice. You know,
it's a really interesting way of structuring it. Well, I wanted to mention before I let you go, I wanted to mention that you'll be here Tuesday. Will you be here in Juneau?
Yes.
In person Tuesday, March 21st. 6 p.m. over at Hearthside Books at the Merchant's Wharf store here in Juneau downtown. And I guess a book signing, but you'll also be talking to Katie Bosler a bit. Is that correct?
Yes. Conversations like this, I'm so excited because it means someone has read your book, asks you questions, and it's a really great way for the audience to get to know an author's work and their book. So
that's fantastic. Well, Melinda Moustakas, her new book is called Homestead, and it's her second book after a collection of short stories. It actually expands on one of the short stories from her first book, Bear Down, Bear North. And both of those will be on sale at Hearthside Books on Tuesday, March 21st at 6 p.m. And you can see and talk to Melinda there in person as she talks to Katie Bosler about her work. Melinda, thanks so much for joining us today. We'll see you up here on Tuesday next week.
Thank you so much. Okay. I'm so excited to be back in Juneau.
Well, that's great. Well, we will welcome you with open arms. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
welcome back to your community-supported public media station, KTOO. This is Juno Afternoon, and I'm Andy Klein. Poetry Out Loud is coming up. Such a great event, always such an amazing event, and we've got folks here to talk to us about it. Amanda Filori is here, Poetry Out Loud coordinator for the Juno Arts and Humanities Council, and Ben Brown is here, the council chair for the Alaska State Council of the Arts. Thanks so much for both of you for joining me. And also, we have someone who is participating in Poetry Out Loud this year, Caitlin Stiles, who's a student at Thunder Mountain High School. So, Caitlin, thanks so much for coming in. It's great to have you.
It's good to be here.
Yeah, it's great. Great to have you here. And we'll talk to you in a second. But let's talk first, Amanda. Let's talk about Poetry Out Loud. It's happening again this year.
It's happening again.
And
I'm so excited. It's in person. The last couple years, we've been doing it online, you know, because of the pandemic and stuff. So I'm just so excited that we're back here in the Capitol, bringing all the students from around the state. It's going to be Monday, March 20th at 5 p.m. at the KTO studio downstairs. So it'll be in person. If you guys want to come and attend, it's free and open to the public. And if you want to watch online, you can go to the KTO.org website and look up, I think it's 360 TV? No, I can't remember. But I think if you just look up Poetry Out Loud and watch now, you'll be able to watch live right then.
Oh, yeah, right. And it'll be very clear on the KTO website, kto.org, you can go to, and you can choose that option. It's such a great space for doing that. And then it's this great AV space, too. So you'll be really well mic'd and well lit and all that stuff. So that'll be really cool. How many participants are in it this year?
So there are 10 state finalists, which is usually we have 10. Sometimes we've had 11. Sometimes we've had 9. But this year we have 10. And they're from all around the state. And for people that don't know what Poetry Out Loud is, it's a poetry recitation competition for high school students. And so basically all of the high schools around Alaska have participated. And we've narrowed it down to the final 10. And I have one of the 10 finalists sitting next to me today. And she's never been on the radio before or never done this before at all. And so
now, is Caitlin our sole representative from the capital city of Juneau, Alaska?
She is representing Juneau. Mm-hmm.
Thank Caitlin. Thank you for representing us in this statewide competition. This
well
exciting.
Done.
This is exciting.
This is very exciting.
I'm not going to ask you to recite your poem or anything like that, but tell me about the subject matter of your poem.
I have to choose three poems to do during it. And I think my favorite is the first one, The World is About to End and My Grandparents Are in Love. It's about like the climate change and the effects it has. And I really like the poem a lot.
That's really fascinating because there's a whimsical nature to the title, but it's about something that's so serious. You know, I'm already interested in I already want to hear that.
Okay, I know. That's great. I kind of encouraged her that I would love to hear a few lines if you wanted to share.
Do you have that? You got it
would
ready
like
to go?
Would you like to share just a few of it?
You got it in the holster, ready to fire?
it's up to you.
Is it like the whole poem? Or
no,
like,
just
do a few.
Lines.
Give us mm-hmm. a flavor for what the poem might be.
Alrighty. It's by Kara Jackson. I forgot to mention that. But still living like they orbit one another, my grandfather, the planet, and grandma, his moon assigned by some gravitational pull, they have loved long enough for a working man to retire. Grandma says she's not tired. And it just goes on like
wow.
that.
Well, wow, you really... I can see why you are one of the finalists right away. That mm-hmm. was very cool.
Yeah, it's a really good poem. You guys should definitely check it out. I really like it a lot.
Ben, tell me about the role that this plays in the overall kind of mission of the Alaska State Council on the Arts.
Well, Poetry Out Loud was the invention of Dana Gioia, who was the chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts back in the George Walker Bush administration long ago in 2004. And so it wasn't our idea, but every state arts agency and the Alaska State Council on the Arts is Alaska State Arts Agency was encouraged and given some money to start this. And every state and territory and jurisdiction has participated every year ever since. And it has grown by leaps and bounds. You know, we used to do the statewide finals in Anchorage at the Alaska Wild Berry Factory. We've done the local ones over at the Jack. It's so nice to be able to bring something to a professional environment like the big KTO studio downstairs. But this is one of many programs that we have in our arts education portfolio. But it's one of my favorites. And it's literally touched the lives I think of millions of American students by now. If you look at the cumulative number of years and all the schools and all the kids who have memorized poems and recited them in their classrooms and gone to grade level competitions and school level competitions and school district competitions and regionals and statewides. So the Alaska State Council on the Arts says a lot. We grant a lot of money to individuals and to arts organizations. We certainly support artists in schools programs so that students like Caitlin can have visiting artists come to their schools. And so her regular teachers know how to use art in their everyday curriculum. But this is just kind of a jewel in the crown. It's super fun. And I always have to say this, but I happened to be in Washington the year that Maeve Ardaz, who was a senior at West Anchorage High School, won the national competition. And it's going to happen again. It's only a matter of time before a talented young Alaskan like Caitlin here will rise to the top.
And if pressure. The pressure's no, no, on, no pressure. Do you feel it?
It's no pressure at all.
But it's a lot of fun, I think. And people really, I've been a judge, you know, for the JDHS finals before and seen varying skill levels. And it really is hard to advance this far in the process. That just to be one of the statewide finalists, we're going to see outstanding performances of all three poems by all 10 students on Monday. I have no doubt.
I think it's really cool, too, because it feels like there's people from all different types of people do this and find their voice in it. Is that true, Caitlin? Do you think that's true?
Yeah, I think poetry is like a wonderful way to like really show your voice to other people. It's a really fantastic like opportunity for everyone to do poetry out loud.
Yeah, because you're sort of like you're interpreting someone else's words, but you're in a way finding your own personal meaning. And if you don't find the meaning in the poem, it feels like you can't quite deliver it the way you need to, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like singing a song or even with a play, you know, when you learn the lines of a play, the playwright's the one who created the character and gave you your lines. But if you don't own those, it's not the same. And so, and I just from that snippet that she, and by the way, I'm not familiar with the poem that you're going to recite, but you obviously, that's a part of you now and you've made it your own personal thing. And I think that's beautiful.
It was really cool. Very, very cool. Well, so the competition, let's talk about this. This is a,
so it's a big some, deal.
There's a
so
big deal
right
here.
Now,
yeah.
So just real quick, you know, it goes from the classroom to the school to regions, and then now we're at the state. So Caitlin might be one of the finalists that move on to the national competition.
Do you know the number it started with in Alaska? How many students, roughly?
How many students? Thousands.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's thousands because it's like there's so many schools. It's like up to like 50 schools. There's like over 200 high schools that can participate in the program. But I would generally say we would get 75 at the highest.
Yeah.
COVID kind of knocked things off
sure.
for a little while. But it's a program that a lot of teachers that have participated encourage other schools and other teachers to bring it in because just like everyone has said here, when you learn a poem, those words stick with you. Like I remember the first poem that I memorized and I was in fourth grade.
Yeah.
You know, and I believe that when you do something like this, like I'm not a writer, I'm not a performer. I've been involved in the arts for a very long time, but I love Poetry Out Loud. This is my ninth year coordinating it because I'm always so inspired by the youth and just the words that they picked, like the poems that they choose. I'm like, wow, I would have never have thought that for you, but you like gave it so much life and I have to dive deeper into it. And it's amazing.
I found that too. Just listening to the few words that you said, I was like, well, that is fascinating that you chose that and that provided particular meaning for you. And you really conveyed that meaning in just those few words. It was great.
And the roster of poems, the anthology is actually chosen by the National Endowment for the Arts in conjunction with the Poetry Foundation. Mm-hmm. So the students aren't just free to go out and find, you know, Tupac Shakur lyrics or anything that they want to recite.
No, they have
that is poetry, though,
those,
I would argue.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But it's nice because it levels the playing field that every student across the country is using the same anthology, which has some classics. You know, for many years, the Jabberwocky was just an old standard. And that's great. But there's a lot of newer poetry in the anthology now, which is great because it's lifting up new poets and new mm-hmm. voices. And
well,
I think,
actually, the poem that Caitlin chose is actually a newer poet that's published with Poetry Out Loud, actually.
Very cool.
And usually people pick like Maya Angelou or different things like that. Like every year there's always like a poem or a poet that is picked. But actually we've had Alaskan poets that are part of the Poetry Out Loud anthology that they're able to recite. I can't think of the name right now, but there are some Alaskan poets and there are newer poems all the time every year, which
That's
is really, really,
cool.
really awesome.
And if you go online and search for Poetry Out Loud anthology, you can see the entire list and in fact the text of all the poems if that's something that a listener is interested in doing. But it really has just helped the entire ecosystem of poetry an art form in this country, bringing people in who otherwise might never have enjoyed it in the same way. So it is a smashing success as far as arts programs go.
Caitlin, were were you interested in poetry before this competition? Have you always sort of had that, or is this something that felt kind of a new thing for you?
It's definitely a new thing. I keep catching myself like coming up with like little poems in my head sometimes, and it's just ever since like joining Poetry Out Loud, I've just discovered a love for it.
See, every educator out there is tingling right now when they hear you say that. It's like, oh, it's inspiring you to do this. Well, that is great. Well, thanks so much for coming in, and thanks for putting you on the spot. Thank you so much for performing that that small piece of the one of the three poems that you're going to be reciting at during Poetry Out Loud. Is that right?
Yeah.
Wow. So that is amazing. You had to get that down and do that, and you've gotten to this point, one of only 10 in the state. Congratulations. It's really an accomplishment.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's awesome. Amanda, thanks so much. Amanda Flory, the Poetry Out Loud coordinator, and Ben Brown, who's the council chair of the Alaska State Council of the Arts, and Caitlin Stiles, student and Poetry Out Loud competitor, finalist, one of 10 in the state. It's all happening Monday, March 20th. That's next Monday. It's right here, 5 p.m. at KTOO, and you'll be able to see the 10 state finalists. Come and check it out in person here at KTOO on Monday. Thanks to all of you for coming in. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Andy.
So
great
much.
Talking
Thank
to you.
You.
Yeah, and thanks again, Caitlin, for reciting that. That was great.
Thank you.
Welcome back to your community-supported public media station, KTOO, on this lovely St. Patrick's Day, listening to the Pogues all day today, as we should. This is Juno Afternoon. I'm Andy Klein, your host for today. And coming up next, we've got folks here who are part of the Alaska Youth for Environmental Action. I kind of have only a couple of names here, and I've got three people in the studio, so I'll just kind of go down and ask you each to introduce yourselves. I'll start with you.
Hello, my name is Tara Lynn Shirley Aguliak Shalista. I live in Anchorage, but I'm originally from Bristol Bay.
Okay.
I'm Sukviak.
Okay, cool.
My name is Josie Adasiak, and I'm born and raised in Fairbanks, Alaska.
All right, you're a Fairbanksan. Mm-hmm. All right, very good. And let me get your name, too.
My name is Suella Wendell. I'm from Chugiak, and I'm Yupik from Bethel area. My family's from Bethel and surrounding.
What area surrounding Bethel?
Nunap and other places.
Yeah.
I forgot.
Yeah, well, that's cool, but it's awesome. That area is amazing. I got a chance to be in that area a little bit a long time ago, and I was just always has been so impressed with it. I always wanted to try to get back there, but haven't. But anyway, very cool. So great to have you all here. I didn't realize that you were all here from sort of different parts of the states and really representing different people.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. Is that a big part of what the organization tries to do?
Oh yeah, definitely, for sure. They bring Alaskan teens from all over. We have had people from Kotzebue during this past summit, and we have people from Fairbanks, and I'm from Bristol Bay, and Suella brings like a unique experience with being from Bethel, and we also have people from Cake and a bunch of other surrounding places.
That's really cool. It must be amazing to be able to meet each other and just kind of share what's different about your experiences, what's similar about your experiences, that sort of thing.
Yeah. We really get to create this unique network of teens around Alaska, like Tara Lynn said, from all over the state, rural communities to the bigger Alaskan cities. Everyone brings really unique thought to what we're doing.
Have you been involved in AYEA for a while now?
Yes. Well, a while. I got involved this fall with the Youth Organizer Summit in October.
And where was that?
That was held in Anchorage at the Alaska Center office.
That's really cool that there's this kind of organization that allows young people in our state from different areas to connect.
Yeah, for sure.
I love it.
Yeah, all three of us were at that past Youth Organizer Summit, and we did a lot of community building, and we had a main value, I guess, placed within us that was going to be on our focus for the upcoming year, and that was to get food out to rural villages in Alaska.
I see. So while it's this, the organization is Alaska Youth for Environmental Action, but mm-hmm. that sounds like it's more social action in a way. Do you kind of tell me a little bit about the mission and how you decide what you're going to work on?
Yeah. So at the Youth Organizer Summit, we kind of picked a theme for the year. That was one of the big things we did. Because just the general blanket of environmental action is kind of a lot to tackle if we want to work on specific projects. So we chose, after much deliberation and a very long consensus meeting, we chose food and food justice as our kind of overarching theme for the year. It ties in with environmental issues of sustainability and food access for people around the state. And we felt it was a really important topic to be covering. And so that is kind of our guiding theme and principle for this year's AIA campaign.
It's fascinating to hear you say that, because Alaska maybe isn't completely unique, but is fairly unique in that way that food safety ties directly into the environment because of our subsistence culture that we have in Alaska that's so important. Mm-hmm. How long have you been involved in the organization, Suella?
We've all been involved around the same time, so okay. Like October.
All joined around the same time, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And have been able to meet in person finally, even if I'm gathering that the pandemic may have kind of interrupted some activities.
In the past, yes, we have some of the people at this summit who were on Zoom and online. But now our summit, the last summit, was in person. And it was like one mm-hmm. of the first ones in person since COVID. Yeah. And
it was
really awesome.
The first one in person. Yes. Yeah.
All right, cool.
They hadn't had an in-person summit for, I think, 2 or 3 years.
That seems like what pandemic. Most organizations have been going through mm-hmm. in the last few years.
For sure.
We should mention that the Juno, there's a summit happening right now. This is the Civics and Conservation Summit that's happening right now. It started today mm-hmm. and is going through Tuesday. Is that right?
Yes. It is. Yeah. We all got in either last night or this morning. Oliver, I know me and Suella came in last night from Anchorage, and there's been like very delayed flights since.
Oh, yeah.
We were the first ones to come in, though.
And what's on the agenda? Have you guys had the first meeting yet, or is that ahead tonight? Or tell me a little bit about what's ahead in this next few days generally.
Yeah, so it's a really packed schedule, 5-day conference, full days. We got in this morning and hit the ground running with kind of intro to Alaskan politics. We are spending this summit talking about bills that we want to focus on that relate to our theme of food justice and relate to the general environmental action. So prior to this summit, we all kind of voted on what bills that are currently active in the Alaska legislature we want to focus in on. And so we have 4 of those bills that we are kind of discussing over the course of this summit. We'll be talking about it as a group, talking with our elected officials, and thinking about how we want to bring back this information to our communities and get more action around that to get our voices heard in this political way.
That's cool. That's really impressive. You know that you're so focused on it. You've decided this general theme, and now you're really taking action on it, and pushing forward in a way that really can make a difference. Mm-hmm. You know, that's really such a cool thing. Are there certain goals, Suella, you have about coming out of this? You know, maybe personal, or goals that the organization has coming out of this summit?
We just want to learn how Alaskan politics work and how we could improve Alaska for our future. And for the summit, we're focusing on 4 different bills, if you would like me to
yes,
talk about that.
Yeah, yeah. We have just a minute or two, but just briefly would be
okay,
great.
So
yeah,
we're focusing on House Bill 33, Oil Spills, Pollution, Penalties, and Prevention. That's the first one.
Okay.
Senate Bill 15, Personal Use Fishing Priority. Senate Bill 34, Citizen Advisory Committee on Federal Areas. And then the last one is combined, like Senate Bill 33 / House Bill 62, Renewable Energy Grant Fund.
Wow. Okay. And do you have are you planning meetings with legislators, things like that coming up?
Yeah. That's going to be towards the end of our summit. that we're going to be doing that. We are building public speaking skills and stuff.
You've got them, by the way. You three have them. That's for sure. You're doing great.
Thank
right
you
here
so much.
In describing what your mission is. It's fantastic. Yeah.
Thank you.
Sorry, I interrupted you. So that's one thing that you're doing. Yeah.
We are also looking at Alaskan politics, as Josie said, and building a lot of other things, like back at where everyone is, they are doing stories of self right now, which is looking at their own personal stories.
Well, I have to cut off our conversation. It's great to talk to you. But again, once again, it's the Alaska Youth for Environmental Action. It's the Civics and Conservation Summit. Thanks so much for taking time out of your summit to come in and talk to me a little bit about what you're doing. It's fantastic. Thanks so much
to
all
us.
Three of you.
Right.
Well, that's it.
Boyana.
Yes, thank you. That's it for Juno Afternoon.